January 14th, 2006, episode number 11, interview with Bob Shirley, a.k.a. Maleth.
This is a Slaga podcast.
How many caches do you have placed right now?
Three right now.
I know one of them is like a decoy.
Red herring.
Yeah, red herring.
Yeah. It's got seven decoys.
There was one cache that somebody put out where when you went to look for it and you found it, you would leave your own decoy too. So the longer it took for you to get there, the more decoys it would be for you to have to go through.
I own my own business, so I set my own schedule. Some days I end up working, you know, 12 or 14 hours. Mm-hmm. And other days I escape as early as possible. Yeah, it depends on the project. We do a lot of programming for Palm Pilots. We do OS development for them, and we do other programming too, but that's one of our main things. And what we do is we put up spec sheets for projects to see if there's anything... If there's any interest in stuff we want to do, because we don't want to do anything we don't want to do. So we put up spec sheets, and when there's interest from it from other companies, we develop the project to a certain point and then sell the entire project to that company we have to finish development on. And that way we don't have to get into distribution and boxing and manufacturing plants.
Do you have to get venture capital, or you be the idea guys and you write the specs and then someone else builds it?
Well, we build up to the basically the alpha stage, kind of halfway between alpha and beta, really.
So you have to do some type of proof of concept.
Oh, yeah. The way I see it is everybody wants things to go to multi-use devices. I think it's nice, but there's problems with it. Because eventually you're going to be forced to buy something that has stuff that you don't want. You're going to end up spending more for a device that should cost less. And I like PDAs a lot. This is my personal one. It's not one through my company or anything. But I have my geocaching stuff on there. I have a few games. And then I have lots and lots of books. Because I think it is a really good book replacement. Problem is if you're going to single task your PDA, do it just for geocaching, you don't have to buy a new one. You go to eBay and spend $20 and get a real, one that's good enough to do geocaching. When I released my last cache, which is called Lost Lump of Coal Number 1, DigiGuy was the first one to show up, which is about usual for the Kirkwood area. And he showed up at 8 o'clock at night. It had been published at 7. And I was there waiting. We ended up talking after he found it, watching to see if anybody else came by. While we're talking, it turns out that the guy that got DigiGuy involved into geocaching, he's actually Max's cousin. I got my first geocoin. And it honors my 100th cache. Caching Place has some milestone coins, and this was the one I got. Yeah, I got 100, 500, 1,000, and they're releasing their 1,500 pretty soon.
Wow.
I think it's a neat idea, and the coins themselves are like $8, and then if you want them engraved with the data, it's another $8.
Mm-hmm. Wanna get,
we can start it.
Hello, everybody. This is Paul Kanapaki. I'm sitting in my dining room with Maleth, a fairly new geocacher. Good to see you.
Hi, folks. Hi, Paul.
We're going to discuss a little bit of his life, his hobbies, and then obviously we'll get into geocaching eventually. Would you tell us, Bob, a little bit about yourself and what some of your other hobbies are?
Okay, sure thing. My name's Bob Shirley, and that's spelled exactly like a girl's name. And you would not believe the amount of torture I had for that as a kid. I was born in Dodge City, Kansas. Another torture item as a kid, being a resident of Dodge City for the first 9 months of my life. And my mom used to trot out the photo of me being sheriff for a day when I was 4 months old, and there I am in my diapers with a big old shiny badge. Mm-hmm. And my dad worked for AT&T, and we transferred. He was born and raised in St. Louis, and he transferred back when I was 9 months old to Kirkwood. When I was 7, we moved across Kirkwood, the big move across Kirkwood, mm-hmm. across to the other side of the tracks, you might say, but there's tracks going all through Kirkwood, so I won't say which side. lived there, went to Kirkwood High School, and graduated in 1983. From there, I went to Merrimack, or Mom I Tried, MIT, and... I went there for 1 year, and at the same time I was doing summer classes at St. Louis University. And as when I was done with Merrimack, I went to St. Louis University for 2 years. I did Merrimack for one, SLU for 2 years, graduated my Bachelor of Science degree in computer science. From there I went to work at Citicorp Mortgage, worked there for a few years, and then in the early 90s, myself and two gentlemen that I worked with there split off and formed our own company. At the time, there was a new product that nobody to this day has heard of called BOS, which was B-E-O-S. And it was an operating system for PowerPC chipsets, a company headed by a guy who used to work for Apple. And we got in on that OS. Operating software development project, and they eventually got bought by 3Com, who owned Palm, and that's how we got started doing Palm stuff, because the B just no longer exists anymore, but we also do Windows development and some other stuff, and we do the projects we like to do.
So after you left Citicorp and you went into business with a couple other people, that's the business that you still have right
still
now?
Still have now. We've been, it'll be coming up on 15 years pretty soon.
Okay. You are developing applications for portable devices now?
For portable devices. We also do Windows devices. What we do is we decide on projects that are interesting to us. We spec those sheets out and we send them out to various companies if they would like us to develop this project for them. It keeps us out of the whole distribution and boxing and warehousing and all that kind of stuff, and we can remain a small company and not have to deal with all the suits in the world.
Mm. How are you involved in the disc golf?
That started when I was a kid. I was probably around 10 years old, and a kid across the street from me and myself, we bought a Frisbee, and it came with a little booklet, games you can play with your Frisbee, and one of them was Frisbee Golf. It just said, you know, pick out a target and count the number of throws to that target, hit the target, and that hole's done, you make another hole. So we made up these courses in our neighborhood. This was back in the mid-70s. Made up courses in our neighborhood, you know, we'd tee off from his parents' porch over to Old Lady Gall's lamppost, and then from her porch to some tree down the street, you know, just silly stuff like that. Well, unbeknownst to me, about the same time we were doing that, the sport was actually gaining popularity in California, Texas, and a few other places, and they actually came up with some permanent hole devices, which are baskets with chains hanging from them. You might, some of you geocachers might have seen them in some parks you've been in. Those were developed in about 1976 or 75, and the first courses started going in 75, 76. The first course in Missouri went in 77, and by that time I was getting close to entering high school and not aware of it, and there wasn't any way for me to be aware of it. But after college and when I was in the workforce, I was tootling around the internet like I was wont to do and discovered a site in Norway that was on some Norway server talking about disc golf. And this site in Norway had information about courses in St. Louis. So we went out to a course and started playing disc golf at the time. That was probably 91, 92 or something like that. And then the local scene had, would organize tournaments on all that, and I started getting involved with that. And today I run the Jefferson Barracks Disc Golf League down at the Jefferson Barracks Disc Golf Course. We have about 60 people every Tuesday night. It's a doubles league, best disc doubles, and give out trophies, and we have pizza parties, and we use some of the funds to build the benches out there. And there's a local club called the River City Flyers, about 11 or 12 courses in the area. We ask the parks for the space, and then we buy the baskets. We design the courses.
What are their particular rules?
Yeah, it's basically golf with a frisbee. These frisbees are specifically designed for the sport, and each of them do different things. Some of them are made for putting, and some of them are made for short range. And then, kind of like how in what we call ball golf, it helps us differentiate between the sports. In fact, I'd played ball golf for years. My dad was a golfer. I played golf on my high school team. Thought for a small period of time in college about trying for a tour card. Mm-hmm. Now I don't even play ball golf anymore because disc golf mm-hmm. is free to play. The equipment is cheap. So now disc golf, the throw is similar to the way you throw a frisbee, but it's also completely different. You really have to experience it. And it takes a while to learn if you've thrown, almost everybody's thrown a frisbee. And if you've thrown a frisbee, you know you can huck them probably about 7,500 feet. Well, we throw the specialized disc for disc golf. I'm not a big arm, and I throw about 350 feet.
Mm. Wow.
Okay, and that's, if you're on a football field, it would be from the back of one end zone to the other and into the stands. Mm. These discs are especially designed for those kinds of throws. And like in ball golf where you have the one iron, the two iron, the three iron, our discs are a little more designed to the flight paths. Like some will go left, some will go right, some tend to go straight.
For me, who's an uninitiated golfer, can I take my Whammo Frisbee out to any Frisbee golf place and just start tossing away?
Sure, y'all. You'll have fun. You'll wonder how, with a Whammo type Frisbee, you'll wonder how everybody else is shooting 54s while you're shooting 108. Uh-huh. Some of the things I did during college was I performed as a comedian, which was on stage a couple nights a week at the local Funny Bone clubs.
That open mic night?
Open mic nights, uh-huh. And then I moved on to actually making money at it for a small period of time. Doing comedy is hard work.
Uh-huh. Comedy is not pretty.
Comedy is not pretty, and it's amazing hard work to get 5 minutes of material that works is about 40 hours of writing. And at the same time, I was training as a professional wrestler. Well, I talk about it from time to time, but, you know, I'm 40 now. My back's not what it used to be, probably due to professional wrestling. But, you know, both of those have aspects of the acting in it. And I auditioned for a local independent movie, and I won the part of a large cop, so I get my 15 minutes of fame as the St. Louis version of Sheriff Buford T. Justice. Mm-hmm. Writing, I've within the last few years, the thing that got me started was discovering what's known as fan fiction on the internet. And fan fiction is basically just people who like different kinds of television shows, and they start writing stories with those characters and release them for free on the internet. It started out with things like X-Files and some of the Star Trek stuff, and then kind of, because of the pseudonym I picked, it started running into shows that weren't my absolute favorite type of shows, but it was like the favorite type of stuff I like to write about in those kind of stories, so I started going more towards like Xena.
Okay.
Which has this huge fan base on the internet. Right. It's unbelievable. And as far as I know, I'm one of the few male writers out there writing Xena stuff.
So that kind of makes geocaching pretty boring of all these other things. So
see,
what got, of all these interests, how do you find room for geocaching?
Geocaching is just another thing that really interests me. And I happen to live in Kirkwood, which I think is a great area to get into geocaching on, because you got guys like DigiGuy, and you got RGS out putting stuff out. The Mad Chef's a new guy, and he's putting stuff out there that's really cool. I'm calling him a new guy, and I'm newer than he is. But, I mean, that's the point. It's that area. There's a ton of these not the normal standard geocache out there, and I like that. Sure, going out and finding the little micro hidden where, you know, whatever normal everyday place it's hidden can be fun for 2 minutes. But going to the Safecrackers cache can be fun for longer than that. I had heard about geocaching on the internet. I heard about it from one of the disc offers who found one of the caches and signed in on I think our Endicott course, which is Endicott County Park. I don't know if that cache is still there anymore. But he found it while playing golf, and he signed in. Yeah, what the heck? He didn't sign in to geocaching. He just signed the log and put it back the way he found it.
But he found it accidentally.
Yeah, he found it accidentally.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, so it had been in the back of my mind that this existed for about a year. And then I got a mailer from Aldi Grocery Store, and they were selling the little yellow Eotrex for $80. Mm-hmm. You know, and at Amazon it was, you know, $99, and you know, anywhere you looked online, it was anywhere from $99 to $110. This was $80. What a deal. Mm-hmm. And so I went and got that one. And the day I bought it, I did two caches, my first one being Hobo Camp. And it's on the what will be the expansion of the Katy Trail. And the next one I did was the Cat's Bird Nest right at sunset, mm-hmm. which was my first multi-cache. You know, and they were both easy, and I knew they were easy going in, and I had printed out the materials and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff, because I knew I was buying the GPS that day, and I did those, and when I got home at night, I'm logging into geocaching.com so I can get my, you know, two finds up there, and I go, there's got to be a better way than printing all these things out. Right, is my first thought.
So your first day, it took me like months and months yeah. before I realized it's got to be another way.
You know, so that night I was going around the forums and I learned about geocaching Swiss Army Knife and Cache Mate and all that kind of stuff. And the next time I went out, I took my Palm Pilot with me and had the caches on that. And I've been paperless ever since cache wow. number three. You know, I like being outdoors. You know, for people who haven't seen me, I'm a big guy. There's just no getting around it. And I'm out of shape. You know, so there's an exercise factor to this mm-hmm. as well. I'm not going to be doing the Daryl and Daryl 4-4.
Four terrain and four difficulty.
Yeah, I'm not going to be doing that tomorrow. Unless I just do like the first leg of it and then go right. back 10 days in a row. You know, I'm just not going to be doing that tomorrow. But, you know, I've gone out and I've done some three terrain stuff that's fairly short. You know, not the huge long hikes that Daryl is. Mm. And I'm looking forward to doing some of those because, you know, disc golf, going back to that, each 18 holes is about a 2 mile hike. Mm. You know, so I can hike the distance. I just don't like going up mountains and down mountains and up mountains and down mountains. And you know, there was just something kind of neat about making up a puzzle for other people to solve, and not, and when they solve it, there's, you know, a reward for solving it, mm-hmm. which is, you know, as little as signing a log and getting a number on the internet to, you know, trading out some prizes mm-hmm. or, you know, equal value stuff in the caches. That's just a neat idea. And when I go caching, is I've got my little GPS and I've got my little Palm Pilot. And I figure out what cache I'm going to next, if, you know, if I'm just out. And I kind of like the randomness of, you know, nearest cache, find out what okay. it is. And then I, you know, use my GPS to drive to that park or wherever it happens to be located. As soon before I get out of the car, I read the description. Okay. And I know there are people out there, and you know who you are, that don't read the description until they're holding the cache or, mm-hmm. you know, until they can't find the cache. Then they read the description and realize that they're not even where they're supposed to be or something right. else, you know. Yeah. Especially, I mean, there's caches like Sarah's fruit salad cache.
Mm-hmm. Which I haven't done.
Okay.
I'm afraid to do it.
Which you haven't done. Now, I've done just the part so I know where it is. I just haven't gone out to get it yet.
Oh, okay.
If you actually go to the coordinates listed, you know, you'll end up in the middle of nowhere because if you read the description, it says the coordinates don't lead anywhere.
As an old seasoned geocacher who's been in this for a while, I remember the day when the coordinates at the top of the page was where the cache was. Now you can't rely on that. You should be able to pull those into your electronic device, just download them into your GPS receiver and go, and there was something there.
When I put out my first cache, which is called Hidden Three Times, and I know you've done that one too, I put a first to find prize in it because it was my first published cache, and I wanted, you know, someone to have something good out of it. So I put it out, geocaching.com, though this should be out within, you know, 48 to 72 hours, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I publish it. I send in the submit file at, like, you know, 5:30 in the evening or something, and then I went out. And I got a call at, like, 8:30 from DigiGuy, who had just found my cache in the dark.
Yeah.
You know? And my first to find prize told him to call me, so I got his address and sent him his first to find prize. But I wasn't even able to watch him hunt for it. I didn't know that Glenn does as good a job as he does getting stuff published as quickly as he does. When I started and started doing caches, and I'd do the 1-1s just to get some experience at, you know, looking for different things or doing some of the 2-1s, and then start moving into some of the more difficult ones at RGS or DigiGuy, or Sarah puts out good stuff. Mm-hmm. Strider's Harwood Court drove me nuts.
Our
Harwood Bug
Drop. Yeah.
It drove me nuts. You know, because I was new. I had no clue.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I went to that one, the particular place that one was hidden wasn't actually at the coordinates. It was about 10 feet away from the coordinates. You know, because it's pretty obvious in the description that what you are looking for is in the pavilion. And it was outside the pavilion when I first started going there. Someone had moved it. And I don't want to give anything more away than that. Which is probably too much anyway. I'm going to have to edit that one.
Once you get close, you know, it's got to be the pavilion, right?
Yeah. You know, that one drove me nuts. I had to go back there probably 4 or 5 times before I found that one. But I think it's fun to find out how different people approach the same puzzles. Just for an example, take Safecrackers, since a lot of people have done that one or at least know about it. There are some people who just fiddle with it and it pops open and they have no clue.
Right.
And there are some people that fiddle with it for hours and, you know, can't get it to what they want. And then there are some people who read the description and understand the very, very subtle clues. Mm-hmm. People that think in different ways and can come to the same conclusion in different ways, that's nifty and that's neat to see.
Mean Gene is another person who you probably respect for his ability to give you a couple of ways to figure things out, or at least challenge you in new ways and how to use math and geography to eventually find out where the cache is.
Yeah. They will also teach you how to use your GPS. Mm-hmm. The first cache I had to project a waypoint on was Crow's Feet's Islands of Webster Groves. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple problems with that cache. It's one of the waypoints I couldn't get to physically because of my size. My hand was too big to get to it, and I had to chopstick that thing out of there. You know, and that took 20 minutes. But the projection, at the time I had the yellow E-Trex, but the E-Trex didn't do the projection. It only did one space past a decimal point on its projection, where her clue was, you know, two spaces past a decimal point, which means I would end up being like 80 feet short. I knew the tile of the cache, so I knew about where it had to be. The 80 foot put me in the center of the road, and right ahead of me was an island of Webster Groves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and, you know, searching those islands doesn't take too long. I happened to go right up to it. I took my best guess where I would put a cache, and that's happened to be where Sarah put it.
Mm-hmm.
Themed series. Did that as a group, and that was fun just as a group because, again, it allows you to see how other people approach, you know, things. It's a good learning experience for a new cacher to go out with the groups, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And it's fun because the people are so cool. You know, it doesn't matter if they're 18 or 80 or or whatever. Is you have the connection through geocaching,
right.
And you know, there's that, but, you know, it's just fun to learn from those people.
Or anything else about yourself, about geocaching, or something that you want to say that we haven't talked about yet?
There's all kinds of tools for use in geocaching. You know, there's the internet, there's Google Earth, there's EDAs, and there's all these kind of tools out there. But everyone should knows, you know, if you're new to geocaching, all you need is your $80 eTrex or your $80 Magellan, so I can be politically correct in talking about both brands. Or, hey, let's talk about those TomTom guys from Europe.
Yeah.
You know, because they're coming into town. But that's all you need. You know, you don't need all the bells and whistles. They're fun. You know, and you might want to approach those at a later date. But all you need is your GPS, and it's fun to go out there and solve the puzzles. It's fun to go out there and find a micro that you've never seen a micro hidden in that particular way before. And there's that thing out there is, oh, no, not another micro. There's a geocoin coming out with that phrase on it. Okay,
you know, you need to get me one of those.
Which is fine, but I think a micro done in an intelligent way can be a good cache. Mm-hmm. You know, granted, we've got the Altoids can Velcroed under another electrical box. I'm new, but I've heard about certain places where someone comes up with a new idea, and then 100 million people put out caches just the same. Mm-hmm. My first micro was a micro that was hidden inside something else that was hidden away. That's why I called it hidden three times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's easy to find, but it's something different. Mm-hmm. And I wrote some really bad poetry for that one. You know, it was out there, and it was different. It was fun. Gates of Doom is one where every bit along the way, because I think there's three waypoints before the final,
mm-hmm.
each one makes you think. And each one makes you think harder than the last. While you're out there exercising your body, it's nice to exercise your brain, too, because you need them both to keep going in the world. The thing about geocaching is you can have fun going out, you know, finding a cache by yourself. And you can have fun going out with a group of people, you know, meeting at a shelter at 9 o'clock in the morning and spending the whole morning doing a series.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun. You can have an event, like my first event was a fall picnic. I'd been geocaching for, a week? and I went out there, and that was fun.
Uh-huh.
You know, meeting new people.
Going on a cave tour.
Going on the cave. I'd done the cave before, but, you know, it's 30 degrees cooler than outside. So
right.
I've done 125 caches now, and I've yet to see a Walmart parking lot cache in St. Louis. And that's a good thing,
because
you do 20 of those and you're bored. You know, I don't want to see another one of those. But if they're different, you know, and we've got the creative, we're lucky enough to have the creative people to do something different. And I hope with some of my caches that I become one of those creative types.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you being on the podcast, Bob, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you at other events and looking forward to some of your challenging caches in the future.
No, you can't miss me. I'm the big guy.
Thanks again.
All right, take care, Paul.
Yep, bye.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.